Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. By now, you've received proposition mailers with endorsements from Alice Huffman, president of the California chapter of the NAACP. What the mailer does not tell you is that Huffman's political consulting firm, AC Public Affairs, has been paid more than $1.2 million so far by ballot measures that she or the California NAACP has endorsed. As CalMatters' Laurel Rosenhall reports, Alice Huffman has been paid by campaigns funded by commercial property owners fighting the tax increase, corporate landlords opposed to expanding rent control, and bail bondsmen who want to keep the cash bail system. Laurel Rosenhall covers California politics for CalMatters with a focus on power and personalities in the state house. She also hosts the Force of Law podcast, which follows California's attempts to reduce police shootings. And a huge thanks to Laurel for bringing this story to our attention. We reached out to the California and National NAACP chapters and Alice Huffman's firm, but we have not heard back. Alice Huffman and the California NAACP declined to be interviewed for Laurel Rosenhall's article. Hi, Laurel. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for writing this story. It is so important to follow the money, especially as, oh my gosh, millions and millions of dollars is being spent on these propositions like Yes on 22, Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and others have spent a whopping $184 million so far. So it's so important to follow the money. Laurel, you write that Alice Huffman was especially sought after this year as political campaigns respond to the national reckoning over race. Before we get into those details, give us a little bit of insight into who Alice Huffman is and the history of her consulting firm.
Yeah, Alice Huffman has been a political powerhouse in Sacramento for many, many years. She came to California in the 1960s and began working in the Jerry Brown administration in the 1970s. She became close with Willie Brown in the 1980s and 1990s when he was the Speaker of the Assembly, and she at the time was a lobbyist for the California Teachers Association. She really helped build up the political power of the teachers union and opened her own public affairs firm in the late 80s. And then in the late 90s, she was elected president of the California chapter of the NAACP. And she's headed up the California's, you know, branch of the NAACP since then, since 1999.
So she's got a long history in California. And as you say, you know, this is not new, her basically opposing or supporting propositions. But you say that she was especially sought after this year as political campaigns respond to the national reckoning over race and frame many of their messages with themes of justice and equity. And in the props I have received so far with her name on it, she says this certain prop will make systemic racism and inequality even worse.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I looked back at the campaign finance filings over many years to see which you know, ballot measures she's been involved in. And, you know, in most elections over the last many cycles, she's worked on a couple of ballot measures. One, two, you know, not just a couple usually every cycle. She is a political consultant, and that's what she does. She is hired to help campaigns win whichever side they're on. But this year it was interesting. She's working on five different ballots. She's being paid by five different ballot measures this year. And so it was noteworthy that it was so many, and that many campaigns, both sides of many of these propositions, are framing their messages in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. It's very obvious that they're sort of honing in on what is in the general discourse. And some of these things are ideas that were percolating long before George Floyd was killed and the Black Lives Matter movement rose to the amount of prominence that it enjoyed this year. But things on the ballot are definitely being framed in that kind of racial justice light, both by both sides in many cases.
So let's talk about one, for example. I got a mailer no on Prop 15. This is the proposition that would reassess property tax rates for big businesses, raising billions of dollars for schools and colleges. We did a show about this last week. Alice Huffman says no on 15. She's got her quote there saying that it'll make systemic racism and inequality even worse. As you report, Alice Huffman's firm received $590,000 from the No on 15 campaign. So where is the transparency, Laurel? Why is it legal for Alice Huffman to have a quote, her only quote? Her quote is prominent on this mailer, and yet we don't learn that she received $550,000 from the No on 15 campaign.
Well, you know, it is reported. That's the thing. I mean, it is reported that she was paid. Why it's not on the mailer, I guess that would be another level of disclosure that, you know, that people could push for if they felt it would be helpful. I think what's tricky here is that she's in the really unusual position of wearing two hats at the same time. And that is that she is a political consultant who has a political consulting firm whose business is to, you know, be hired by political campaigns and help their side win, whatever it is. She's also the president of the NAACP. And most people who are paid by political campaigns, who are those political consultants who make their money working on campaigns, don't also have a role as prominent as being the head of the NAACP. And so I think that's what makes her situation unusual. I don't think that most voters would be surprised that someone who's showing up in an ad for a political campaign is being paid by that political campaign. But what's different is when you see someone who is has a role in a civic organization. I think that's maybe where the confusion comes in, because she's identified through her affiliation with the NAACP rather than her affiliation as a political consultant.
Exactly. And in the case of the No on Prop 15 mailer, there is a photo of a Black woman who's clearly, you know, standing in her business. And in the quote, Alice Huffman says that Black and Latino businesses will be hurt by Prop 15. In this case, we really should know that her firm got paid. We reached out to the California NAACP, the National NAACP, and Alice Huffman's firm. They did not respond. You also reached out and you didn't get a response, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I spoke with the people at the National NAACP and they said they were going to put someone on the phone with me for this article, and then they never actually did. And I tried many, many times to follow up, told them what I was working on and asked for the interview. They never made it happen. And Alice Huffman at one point agreed to an interview and then declined. So in both cases, I couldn't get any input from them. But I did talk to Black leaders around California, including some leaders of local NAACP chapters in Oakland and San Jose. And so I did get a lot of input from African-American communities around California.
You spoke with Carol Fife, who's an officer of the Oakland chapter of the NAACP, who disagrees with Alice Huffman and her support or opposition to props. And she said, "I feel it's a conflict of interest, and I think it's misleading to the public. It's unfortunate. Politics is gross."
Yeah, Carol said that she doesn't feel like she and her chapter, her Oakland chapter of the NAACP, have a clear understanding of how the California NAACP reaches its decisions on what it endorses, the positions that it takes. So she said it's just not very clear to her how those decisions are made, and she's not happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question that we wanted to ask the national chapter is, You know, how can she do this on behalf of the California NAACP? Because she's her name and the logo are all over the place. In fact, when I posted your article, Laurel, on social media, a lot of people said, wow, I was wondering why I've been seeing the NAACP on all of these mailers.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback like that, too, after we published this article. And one thing I can say is that in researching this issue, I read articles from the past that were about the NAACP endorsements in past years. And Huffman was quoted in those articles saying that she only agrees to take a client, a paid client, if it's a campaign that the NAACP has already endorsed. So she told those reporters that the endorsement comes first and then her business work sort of comes second to bolster the position of the NAACP board. Again, she wouldn't talk to me, so she hasn't directly told me that. The dates on when some of these payments began don't really line up because many of them began early in the year before most groups would typically make their endorsements on a November ballot. So I don't know because she wouldn't talk to me, but that is what she has said in the past.
Well, we probably saw one of the same articles. The Guardian did interview her in 2018 when she opposed the rent control measure.
Right.
And she said, quote, "I don't apologize for it. I don't see it as a conflict of interest." And then they asked about her consulting firm and, you know, why these organizations would choose her. And she said, quote, "I took the highest bid."
Yep, I read that one too.
Well, what about the rules? Because I think the next step for us is to reach out to the Secretary of State's office and ask, you know, why is this allowed?
I'm not really sure where to go with that. Endorsements, are you saying endorsements, it shouldn't be allowed for someone to endorse, or it should be have to be disclosed every time if someone who appears in an ad is paid,
Well, it seems like if someone as prominent as the president of the NAACP mm-hmm. has the only quote on a mailer, people should be told that she has received money from the campaign.
Yeah, I guess that's a question about whether the law should require it, the disclosure on the mailer itself. Most of the disclosure rules have focused on the primary funders of that mailer, right? So that there is some disclosure on that mailer, but it probably just says like California Business Roundtable or something, whoever the large donor is supporting the No on 15 campaign. I think more information for voters is always a good thing. It is hard to get a lot of disclosure when on these political ads, you know,
right.
There's the movement has largely been focused on who's funding the ad as opposed to who's appearing in the ad. And so maybe what you're talking about is sort of changing the focus or adding another layer of disclosure when people appear in the ad. And I think that would be helpful to voters.
Yeah. Well, and again, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Let's go over just a few of the other props that she's being paid for. As you report, Alice Huffman and her political consulting firm are being paid $280,000 from the No on 21 campaign. And this is the proposition that would allow cities to pass rent control measures on rental housing as long as it's more than 15 years old. And we did a show about that yesterday. She's also received $200,000 from the No on Prop 25 campaign. Prop 25 would make California the first state to replace cash bail with an algorithm. And then the other one, this is a huge one. She's received $85,000 from the Yes on 22 campaign. We also did a show about that. And this is the prop that would exempt companies like Uber and Lyft from a new state law requiring them to treat workers as employees. You know, I think the other confusing thing here, Laurel, is that some of the local NAACP chapters are on the opposite side of Alice Huffman on these props.
It is confusing, and I think it gets to kind of the key piece that this issue you're raising in your last question about the disclosures get at, which is that, you know, propositions are really hard for voters to understand. They don't have a lot of the usual clear political markers that we use to help us understand where we land on something, right? Like they're not partisan, so you can't usually clearly say, oh, Democrats are for this one and Republicans are for that one, and line up your decision that way. They are usually these complicated policy issues that most ordinary people haven't given a lot of thought to. And they typically don't have a face of a politician affiliated with them so that you could even make a decision based on more of an emotional decision making that voters use for sometimes of just like, oh, I like that person, or I like what they're saying, or, you know, I agree with them. So on these propositions, voters really rely on endorsements a lot. You know, that's a critical way of deciding how to vote, is just looking at what groups are for it, what groups are against it, and kind of deciding which of those groups are more in line with your values. And so that is one of the things that makes both an endorsement from the NAACP so sought after by many campaigns, because that is an endorsement that means something to many voters. Voters are going to be more familiar with that brand than they are with some of these complicated policy questions. And it also makes it really confusing for voters when you realize that not all these endorsements mean the same thing. You know, some groups, an endorsement, there's no money involved, and others there is. And in most groups, if there is money involved, the money is flowing the opposite direction. The endorsing group gives money to the campaign, not the campaign giving money to the endorsing group, though it does happen both ways. It's just that without a lot of digging, voters won't know that.
Right. Well, and that is why it is so important to support independent media. We are joined today by Laurel Rosenhall. Laurel covers California politics for Cal Matters, and you can find the piece she recently wrote, California NAACP President Aids Corporate Prop Campaigns, collects $1.2 million and counting. We reached out to the California and National NAACP and Alice Huffman's firm, AC Public Affairs, but have not heard back. Alice Huffman and the California NAACP also declined to be interviewed for Laurel's article. We're going to stick with this for about five or so more minutes. So if you have any questions for Laurel about what she found, and questions overall about really the obscene amount of money being spent on these propositions, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And we got a call from a listener who said, Alice Huffman's arguments are also in the voter's pamphlet as the head of the NAACP, implying that that's an NAACP endorsement.
Yes, that was actually kind of the starting point for my research, was I was looking through my pamphlet and noticing on how many ballot measures that she appeared. It caught my eye, and it sort of started me down this path.
Well, thank you for that. We also got an email from Sheila who said, I'm so glad to hear at long last the needed expose of the NAACP taking money. Awful and necessary to hear this. I often wondered why they were against the sugar tax in Berkeley. She writes, I confronted them one day at the BART station at Ashby and asked them how they could be against something that would only help people of color who suffer from diabetes, and they could never come up with a sane response. Sheila says, thank you for putting this forward at this moment. Well, it just kind of makes you want to interview them even more, Laurel, just to find out, you know, how do you all come to agreement on this? I mean, what goes on behind the scenes?
There's a real lack of information about that. So, it's a private membership group. So it's not like it's a government entity that has to kind of report out its decisions. But as a very renowned group with a major history in our country of supporting civil rights and voting rights, you would think that there would be more transparency about how they make their decisions. But I found that their website is super out of date. It doesn't have any positions posted since like 2016. There's not a clear explanation of how they make their endorsements. I called multiple members of the executive board for the California NAACP, and they either declined to be interviewed or didn't respond to me. There's really not much transparency about who's making decisions or how they're making them.
Is there anything else we need to know when it comes to following the money, Laurel? Have you uncovered anything else since writing that piece?
Well, since writing this piece, you know, some people have contacted me about other individuals or other campaigns that have, you know, paid organizations or paid individuals that also endorse that side in that ballot measure. So I want to be clear that it's not unheard of, but what is unusual and noteworthy about this situation is both the amount of money changing hands and the prominence of the organization. And those are the two things that really make this one much more newsworthy, because you're talking about more than $1 million and you're talking about an organization that has, you know, more than a century of history in our country in supporting civil rights and advocating for ending segregation and voting rights and other things that have really helped it build a reputation that means something to a lot of people, even people who aren't super politically engaged. And so it does seem reasonable to expect that they would explain how they make these decisions.
Right. And gosh, is there any way to know how much influence they are having on these different propositions?
I don't know of sort of a scientific way to measure that.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, Alice Huffman is showing up in a lot of ads. I've seen her in ads against the split roll measure and against the cash bail measure. And, you know, she puts out this, her political consulting firm puts out this publication called The Minority News, which looks like a small newspaper, but is mostly a sort of paid for, I would say it has kind of like advertorials. It has pieces of writing that look like articles, but mostly support positions that of campaigns that have paid her consulting firm. And the pieces are written by her as the leader of the NAACP. Sometimes they're written by Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and former assembly speaker who she has a long time professional relationship with. And so this is another thing that can be confusing sometimes, this minority news. But it is, it's more like a slate mailer, which is another thing you might want to do a show on sometime, because these slate mailers can be extremely confusing. Most of they show up in the mail looking like an organization endorsing a bunch of positions. But in fact, mostly they're really paid ads that campaigns just pay to be on one side or another on those slate mailers. So it is difficult. I really suggest that voters look as much as possible for independent information on the ballot measures. And I will give a plug for CalMatters Voter Guide at calmatters.org. We have information from our independent journalists on all of the ballot measures, statewide ballot measures. We analyze the money. We explain why this is on your ballot, who's funding it, who's funding the opposition. And we have really catchy, short, one-minute videos that explain what the ballot measure would do. So I hope people will check it out and use trustworthy sources of information when they vote.
We are huge fans, so thank you to you and your team for putting that together. Before we let you go, Laurel, you wrote a story about Proposition 24, and again, a lot of people are confused about this one.
Yeah.
So Prop 24 would change California's data privacy law. It would let you tell businesses to limit the use of sensitive data, like exact location, health information. It would prohibit businesses from holding onto your data, which all sounds great. The confusing thing here is that you've got the consumer watchdog, Representative Ro Khanna. Oh, and there's Alice Huffman, who's for it. Those against, the ACLU, Consumer Federation of California, Public Citizen. And they say that the reason why they're against it is because one man, Alistair McTaggart, put this on the ballot.
Yeah, this is this one is confusing because it's really divided privacy advocates. You have basically on both sides, you have privacy advocates who say this is going to make our existing privacy law even stronger. And then you have those who say this just sort of cements in the worst parts of our privacy law and isn't worth supporting. So it's quite confusing. It is funded entirely by Alistair McTaggart, who is a real estate developer in the Bay Area. And he led an effort a few years ago to push for a new privacy law that the legislature passed in 2018. And it put California on the map as having the strongest privacy protections in the nation. And he says now that, you know, it's not strong enough, and he wants to do this ballot measure to strengthen it. But there's a lot of disagreement about whether it would strengthen it or not. And some of the things that opponents object to are things that are already in the law anyway. So it gets even more confusing. But even if Prop 24 were to fail, some of the things that opponents don't like about Prop 24 are still going to remain in the existing law. For example, it allows what they call pay for privacy, which means that it's legal for companies to charge a higher rate if customers want to opt out of having their data sold, with the idea being that, you know, your data, your personal data has value, and if you're opting out from telling a company not to sell it, then they're losing a little bit of money, and so they could charge you for that service. So maybe that's on like an Evite. The paid version would become the privacy version, and the free version would be the one where they sell your data, for example. So things like that's one thing, for example, that opponents of Prop 24 really hate about Prop 24 is that it expands the pay for privacy provisions, but the pay for privacy provision is in California law anyway. So even if Prop 24 fails, that piece of it is just remains in the law, just not as broad as it would be under Prop 24. But it is confusing, and I hope people will, you know, look at the article and the video we did on that, because there are strong arguments on both sides of that one.
Alistair McTaggart, the real estate developer, is spending almost $6 million to get Prop 24 passed. Why does he care so much about this issue?
He says that he was, that this all began a few years ago when he attended a dinner party with a Google engineer who, in the course of their conversation, the engineer told him that Americans would be shocked if we knew how much Google knows about us. And so he says he really just like took this on as a passion project a few years ago. After learning that was before Cambridge Analytica and similar stories came out that really brought internet privacy to public awareness. And so there's no indication that he has a, you know, professional interest in this. It's more like he has a personal interest in it, and he has enough money to push it. You know, getting a measure on the ballot does require a lot of money. So it, and then, you know, it, it, he, by putting, he pushed it a few years ago and basically convinced the legislature to do something about it by doing a ballot measure that he then took off the ballot when the legislature passed the law. And now he's back with this one, which they would, which he would consider sort of a cleanup. But, you know, it is a little bit odd to have one person, driving so much policy, but that, that happened. That is, the initiative process in California allows for that. You know, we have that. Individuals, corporations, and unions are basically the entities that use the initiative process. That's how it works. It costs a few million dollars to get something on the ballot. And so that's who does it. It's people, it's individuals who have the means, or unions, or companies. And pretty much everything that's on your ballot this year, has backing from one of those, except for a small handful that were put on by the legislature. But for the most part, that's how the initiative process works.
What a system. We're definitely going to do a show about what needs to change after the election. So many shows to do after the election. So that is Prop 24, and it is opposed by the Consumer Federation of California, California Nurses Association, League of Women Voters, in addition to the major donor, Alistair McGart. It's also endorsed by Consumer Watchdog and Common Sense Media. Laurel, thank you so much for all of your reporting, especially the one on the NAACP, and thanks to your team for the excellent voter guide.
Thanks, Rose.
Laurel Rosenhall covers California politics for Cal Matters. You can also find election briefs from KALW's news department, 2-minute election briefs about California propositions and local measures, and you can find those at kalw.org. Coming up after a break, we will discuss California Proposition 17, Voting Rights Restoration for Persons on Parole. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is a special election edition of Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and now we are going to talk about California Proposition 17. Under California law, people with felony convictions lose their right to vote if they are in prison or on parole. Proposition 17 would grant voting rights to those individuals. Today, 55,000 Californians are on parole. According to the Public Policy Institute of California, Black and Latino Californians are disproportionately represented. By the end of 2016, Black Californians accounted for 6% of the state's adult population, but 26% of the state's parole population. Latinos made up 35% of the adult population, but 40% of those on parole. Joining us to talk about Proposition 17 is Kira Lerner. Kira is a staff reporter at The Appeal and a Lipman Fellow at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Hi, Kira. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, Proposition 17 is so important. Can you tell us first how it got on the ballot?
Yeah. So Proposition 17 is one of a small number of propositions this year that were placed on the ballot by the state legislature. It was approved by 2/3 majorities in both houses, and that's why it's going to be on the ballot this year. And because of that, it, as opposed to the proposition you were just discussing, it has a lot less money involved. There's been less money spent on both sides of the campaign. And it's really being led, the campaign for yes on Proposition 17 is being led by impacted people, people who would regain their right to vote if this were to pass on the November 3rd ballot.
So you have the League of Women Voters in California for it, Governor Gavin Newsom. You've got the ACLU of Northern California, as you said, less than $1 million is being spent on this. Patty Quillen, the wife of Netflix co-founder Reed Hastings, is a donor. Major donors in opposition, none. No money has been spent against this. According to CalMatters, the only groups against it are the Crime Victims United of California and Election Integrity Project California. So tell us about Prop 17. What would it do exactly?
Exactly. So Prop 17 would restore the right to vote to, like you said, roughly 55,000 California residents who are currently on parole. Some of them are serving short periods of parole, just a few years. Some of them are sentenced to life on parole, meaning that if this were not to pass, they would effectively be disenfranchised for the rest of their life. And so California, by considering this initiative, is really joining some of the momentum that we've seen across the country in recent years to undo these Jim Crow era disenfranchisement laws and restore voting rights to people who have completed their sentences. California, if this passes, would join 18 states and the District of Columbia that all allow all eligible citizens who are not actively in prison to vote. Meaning as soon as someone is released from prison, they would be able to re-enter society, would have to find a job and housing and everything that comes with it. And at the same time, they would be permitted to vote.
You mentioned life on parole. How common is that?
It's not all that common, but there are a significant number of people who do serve life on parole. I talked to one man, a man named John Windham, who was sentenced to a period of 7 years to life on parole. So he doesn't yet know if he will spend the rest of his life. It's a decision that'll be made based on how a board thinks that he is doing with his parole time. So life on parole is reserved for more serious or violent offenders, but proponents of Prop 17 say it shouldn't matter what offense you committed. Taking the right to vote away from someone for the rest of their life is just unconstitutional.
As you report, John Windham was released from a California state prison in 2018, and he's become an advocate in his community for criminal justice reform. When you were talking with him about people with felony convictions losing their right to vote, he said, quote, "It hurts. It's disappointing. I feel as though I've committed treason against my country and they're stripping me of my citizenship, but allowing me to stay instead of kicking me out."
Exactly. It was so interesting for me to talk to John Windham because he is so active in his community. He started a nonprofit to help ex-offenders reintegrate into society. He said he has Zoom calls every day with members of the legislature and with other advocacy groups trying to fight for criminal justice reform. But at the same time, just because he was put on a period of parole after his sentence, he can't actually vote for the lawmakers that he talks to all the time.
Why is it taking California so long to do this? As you report, last year, New Jersey adopted legislation restoring voting rights to 80,000 people on probation and parole. Early last year, Nevada restored rights to 77,000 people. And in Colorado, almost 11,500 people on parole regained their rights after the state passed a bill last year.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, for a so-called progressive state, California is really behind the curve on this. I think there's been more appetite and more momentum in recent years to consider the racist impact of these Jim Crow era laws. I think for a long time, people just weren't thinking about it. Voting rights restoration just wasn't in the mainstream conversation. And people thought it was easy enough to say, hey, you committed a crime. You should have to suffer everything that comes with that. And with that is losing your voting rights. But I think now we're in a moment where the conversation has shifted even further. And there's a number of states considering completely eliminating felony disenfranchisement, meaning even if you're in prison, you would still have the right to vote. Washington, D.C. was the first jurisdiction to do that recently, and Maine and Vermont have never prohibited people in prison from voting. So I think as this conversation moves even further along, California realized just how far behind the state was, and it was time to catch up.
Today, we are speaking with Kira Lerner about Proposition 17, which would allow people on parole in California to vote. If you have any questions for Kira about Prop 17, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Kira is a staff writer for The Appeal. This is a really incredible journalism outlet that focuses on how policy, politics, and the legal system impact the country's most vulnerable people. They do incredible work of holding officials accountable. She's also a fellow at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Kira, in your piece, you cite polling that finds 63% of California voters support Proposition 17, which needs a simple majority of the vote to pass.
Exactly. I think that's one of the reasons that really begs the question, why did we wait until now to do this? But it's true. It's polling at over 60%, probably largely because there's no organized campaign against it. And criminal justice advocates have said that they expect that polling to be accurate. They expect it to pass. And then they hope to move even further as the years go by, as these people re-enter the democratic process and start casting their ballots. Maybe then we can consider other forms of criminal justice reform and eventually ending felony disenfranchisement altogether.
Right. And again, just to repeat the information about Prop 17, in case you missed it, you've got the League of Women Voters in Favor, Governor Gavin Newsom, Californians for Safety and Justice, ACLU of Northern California. The yes side is spending just under $1 million, actually really low for propositions. And then on the no side, no major donors. No side is Crime Victims United of California and the Election Integrity Project California. I've never heard of that group. What do the no people say?
Yeah, so the no people claim that if you are convicted of a crime, you made that choice and you should serve the punishment that comes with it. They like to talk about the serious nature of these crimes, the violent aspects, and they like to focus on the punitive aspects of disenfranchisement. But like you've said, no money has been spent on the no campaign, and it's really amazing to see so much energy and enthusiasm for the yes campaign while no money has been spent on the other side. And I'll just point out, we saw something really similar in Florida in 2018 when the state passed Amendment 4 to restore voting rights to people who had completed their sentence. So that was a little bit different. That included the completion of parole. And during the campaign for Amendment 4, there also was no organized opposition. Hmm. Once the amendment passed with almost two-thirds of voters supporting it, then we saw some backlash and we saw Republican lawmakers pass a bill chipping away at it and making people with felony convictions have to pay off legal financial obligations, so fines and fees associated with their sentence before they could vote. But folks I've talked to in California have said this is a Democratic-controlled state. The legislature and the governor are very unlikely to do anything if this were to pass that would chip away at it in the same way that Florida did.
Right. And we know that a number of organizations, including Michael Bloomberg, are raising money so people in Florida can actually vote.
Right. That's an effort that's necessary because of the law that the Republican legislature and the governor signed. And then there was a series of court decisions. And eventually the requirement that fines and fees be paid was upheld. So people like Bloomberg and LeBron James, the basketball player, have thrown a lot of money at Florida in an effort to make sure that people with felony convictions can register and can vote in the upcoming election.
Right. And it's incredible. 700,000 people still owe legal financial obligations and they cannot vote unless they pay that off. And that's what these organizations are trying to do. You know, the other thing that's really changed over the past couple of years, Kira, and you all do an amazing job of writing about this, is actually talking to people who have been in prison, like John Windham. And when I think about the Florida campaign, so many incredible activists have done such, you know, grassroots work to try to raise awareness about this issue and really educate people. And these are people who serve time in prison.
It's true. I think these people kind of just got fed up with waiting for lawmakers to do the work for them. In Florida, it had been decades, and Florida was one of just four states that permanently disenfranchised everyone with a felony conviction. So it was an extremely punitive state. One in four Black men were disenfranchised because of this law, and nothing was changing. So people who were impacted decided to take matters into their own hands. The campaign for Amendment 4 was led by Desmond Meade, who has turned into an incredible activist for ending disenfranchisement. And I think it was so important that so many people involved were personally impacted and they were able to really eloquently share their own stories and experiences. And there were people on both sides of the aisle. There were Democrats and Republicans, men, women, all across the state who spoke out and talked about their experiences. And I think because voters heard so many of those stories, it became much more compelling for them to vote to approve Amendment 4. And I think the same thing is happening in Florida. The campaign is being led by people who themselves are on parole. And the more voters hear about these people and their experiences, the more appealing Prop 17 becomes.
And again, can you tell us what are the major differences between Florida's Amendment 4 and California's Prop 17?
Yeah, so Prop 17 in California restores the right to vote to people on parole. So these are people who have left prison but who are serving a period of parole. And there's roughly 55,000 people who would qualify. In Florida, in order to regain your right to vote, you have to complete all terms of your sentence. And all terms of your sentence includes the period on parole. So in Florida, you still cannot vote if you are currently on parole.
What else really stands out for you when you interview people who've been in prison about the importance of having the right to vote?
I'm always just struck by how important and enthusiastic people are, how important people think voting is, and how enthusiastic they are about exercising their civil rights. I followed so many people to the polls on election day who are voting for the first time after a period of incarceration. And it's a really emotional time for these people. I mean, imagine spending a long period of time in prison and feeling like you don't count at all. You can't have a say in what's going on, and you're feeling really ostracized by society. And I think voting is both really symbolic for people and an actual concrete way that they can feel like they're reintegrating into society. And research has shown that people who are leaving prison, who are allowed to vote, are less likely to return to prison because they feel a part of their community. They feel wanted and included. I think that people do not take this for granted, and it's really always amazing for me to see that.
What do you think, now that people in prison are, you know, really speaking out about issues and organizing, if Prop 17 passes, what do you think is next for criminal justice reform in California and really across the country? Because as we said, California is really late when it comes to this issue.
Yeah, I think there's so many different things that criminal justice reform advocates are focusing on across the country. So many different ways that we should be reforming this incredibly broken justice system. One big part of it is related to voting rights. And like I mentioned, a lot of states are working to get rid of felony disenfranchisement altogether. There's other issues with the criminal justice system all across the country, our treatment of juvenile offenders. I talked to a lot of people who lost the right to vote when they were incarcerated before they were 18, so they were never able to vote. And they are very vocal about issues with juvenile justice in this country. California and other states across the country rely heavily on things like gang enhancements to severely punish people. There's a million directions that this can go. And I think it's really important that these people who themselves are personally impacted are leading and steering this conversation.
You know, we were just reminded that during the election, Bernie Sanders was saying that he wants people in prison or jails to have the right to vote. According to NBC, only two states, Vermont and Maine, allow prisoners to vote from behind bars, regardless of their conviction status. Do you think that this will gain any more traction?
Yeah, one small just correction on that. Washington, D.C. also just restored the right to people who are currently in prison. So it's now Maine, Vermont, and Washington, D.C. I was excited when Bernie Sanders talked about that on the campaign trail, because it started a conversation that I don't think we as a nation have really had enough recently about why do we link the right to vote with incarceration. And when Bernie Sanders was asked that question during a town hall, the question was framed in a way to kind of point out the worst of the worst offenders. The question was about the Boston Marathon bomber and whether Bernie thought that he should be permitted to vote while incarcerated. But I think because Bernie kind of like raised the issues with felony disenfranchisement as a whole and talked about the racist roots of these laws, we've really been able to move the conversation away from just focusing on the worst of the worst offenders. And I think slowly more people are realizing that most democratic countries, similar to the United States, do not tie the right to vote to incarceration. And we're really an outlier in how we do that.
Well, Kara, thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Kara Lerner is a staff reporter at The Appeal. This is a great journalism outlet that focuses on how policy, politics, and the legal system impacts this country's most vulnerable people. Kara is also a fellow at the Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. We've been talking about Proposition 17, which would allow people on parole in California to vote. And there's so much on the ballot. I know it can be a bit overwhelming. CalMatters has an amazing voter guide that follows the money. And then KALW, if you look at KALW.org, if you click on the ballot box on the front door, you can find all of the election shows that we've done over the past few months. You can also find the news department's election briefs. They always do an amazing job of providing information on the propositions and local measures in 2-minute election briefs, so it shouldn't take you much time. And you can find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.